Chapter 6. Monlo Harbour, Nerth, the next day. The sky was sapphire. The dusty earth, cinnamon. Under the alien sun, the expedition's Imperial Army forces formed a corridor. To one side, the Geno Chiliad, the Zanzibari Hort. To the other, the Outremars, the Sixth Torrent, the Thorns. Ranks of armoured warriors stood ready, 90 deep, their banners and standards fluttering in the wind. Battle tanks and armoured speeders elevated their weapon mounts in salute. Horns bawled into the morning. Kettle drums clattered incessantly. Amon Jeveth's titans formed a towering backdrop, backlit by the scalding Nerthine sun. Overhead, the slow skies turned. The wind made a reptilian hiss, and the noise of the drums almost drowned out the sounds of screaming coming from the city 10 kilometres away. Namatjira was wearing gold plate armour, with a fan of ostrich feathers around his head and a 10-metre cape of peacock eyes held out behind him by his slaves. Liquid gold had been delicately painted onto his face by his cosmeticians, and it had dried to form a tissue-thin mask. He held a silver Mughal mace in one hand, the sunlight glinting off its many jewels, and a golden ritual santi in the other. The torso of his armour was engineered with 2 extra pairs of cybernetic limbs, and these spread to clutch a pair of daggers and a pair of sabres. 6 arms extended, Namatjira resembled the death goddess of ancient Sindh myth. The Lucifer Black companions surrounded him, swords drawn, holding stiff ritual poses of defence. The thylacine lay at Namatjira's feet in the dust, licking its coat. A marsupial tiger from Taprobane, it was one of the many lost species back-geneered from DNA samples during the unification era. Namatjira's pet was called Serendip. It gazed out at the day's heat with hooded, disinterested eyes. Major General Dev stood at Namatjira's right hand in bronze battle armour, his turbaned crimson and his spiked helm silver. Dev carried a gurz and a long-handled sword. Next to him stood Lord Wild of the Torrent, his platinum war gear glittering with rubies and emeralds. Lord Wild's augmetic eyes were glowing green slits in his white ceramic face mask. He personally carried the Vexil standard of the Torrent, a 4-metre golden pole surmounted with a diamond-checked tail and the gilt crest of the Pontus Euxinus. Third in line was General Karsh of the Regnault Thorns, his ritual chrome armour so thwart with spikes and recurve barbs that he seemed more the embodiment of a vicious trap than a person. To Namatjira's left stood Khedive Ismail Sherard of the Outremars, a congenital dwarf dressed in graphite grey robes and a brow circlet of titanium. His stature belied his level of influence in the army and the hierarchies of terror. Though the Outremars had supplied just 5,000 foot soldiers to Namatjira's expedition, far fewer than the Chiliad, the Torrent, or the Thorns, they were the backbone of the Imperial Army, accounting for almost 7% of the army's overall numbers. Outremar troops served in almost all expeditions and martial hosts, and their Khedives, all dwarfs of the same blood dynasty as Sherard, were famed for their tactical insight and discipline. The Grand Khedive, Sherard's great uncle, was one of the Emperor's foremost advisers and confidants. Khedive Sherard stood on a small grav disc suspended 0.5 metre above the sand. The train of his grey robe, cut with a bat wing edge, was held out behind him by unicoid slaves, each slave pulling taut a point of the bat wing so that it seemed as if Sherard was spreading great pinions to ascend into the sky. Beside him stood Sri Vet, who held the rank of Uxor Primus of the Geno 5-2 units attached to the expedition. She was sheathed in a red burqa and escorted by 13 of her most senior Uxors, including Honan Mu and Ruxana Said. 40 burnished servitors held long poles supporting billowing white canopies above the expedition commanders, shielding them from the sun's bite. A trans-atmospheric craft slid down out of the blue, roared over the assembled multitude, and settled with a whine of dampers at the end of the long troop corridor. The drums stopped playing. The horns stopped braying. There was silence, apart from the crack of the canopy sheets and the distant screaming of Mon Lo. A figure emerged from the craft and began to walk down the corridor towards the waiting commanders. Namatjira nodded, and as one, the vast host of men dropped to their knees. Banners, flags, and standards sloped forwards in deference. The lone figure came closer, trudging down the sand of the corridor, nodding in respect to the men bowed down on either side of him. The figure wore silver-edged purple power armor. He was fully a third taller than the tallest Geno warrior in the muster. There was an awed hush. It took almost 8 minutes for the Astartes to walk down the entire corridor to Namatjira. In that eternity, the only things that moved were the wind-caught banners, the slow-turning clouds, and the Astartes himself. 10 meters short of Namatjira and his commanders, the Astartes stopped. Slowly and deliberately, he removed his left gauntlet and dropped it onto the hot sand. Then he unlocked his helm, drew it up over his face, and dropped that as well. His head, revealed, was noble. Hairless, powerful, copper-skinned, his eyes were as bright as the sapphire sky. He drew his gladius with his right hand and sliced its edge across the palm of his bared left hand. Tossing the short sword aside, he knelt, holding out his left hand to Namatjira. Blood dripped from the deep palm wound onto the sand. "Respected Lord," he said, his head on his chest, "worthy and appointed master of the 670th expedition, I pledge my forces and my allegiance to you, recognizing you as the proxy of our beloved emperor in this theater. It is my honor to add the Alpha Legion's strength to your fighting force. United, may we annihilate our common foe. To this end, I offer tribute in blood." Namatjira spread all 6 of his arms and allowed the Lucifers to take his weapons from him. One of them also removed the golden glove sheathing Namatjira's real left hand. Namatjira stepped forwards, his slaves releasing his long cape of peacock eyes so that it floated out behind him on the breeze. He stroked his bare left hand down one of the spikes of Kash's armor, then held it out, dripping, to meet the proffered hand of the kneeling Astartes. Their bloody palms pressed together and gripped tightly. "I receive your tribute," Namatjira replied, "and respond with my own blood. The expedition rejoices that you have joined us. Welcome. I am Namatjira, and this is my pledge for the Emperor." The hands parted. The Astartes rose to his feet. He towered over the Lord Commander. "I am Alpharius. For the Emperor, my lord." "Really? Are you?" Grammaticus murmured to himself. 2 kilometers away, he was observing the great meeting through a high-power scope from the flat roof of the Terracotta Palace's kitchen block. He kept low, carefully avoiding the eyesight range of the palace sentries, the jamming module attached to his belt non-invasively blocking the field sensors and the stationed gun servitors. His scope was a quality piece, an Eldar long gun sight, another gift from the Cabal. It resonated the images back into his eye, almost as though he was standing at Namatjira's shoulder. He could not hear their words from that distance, of course, but he read lips as well as any high-function logokine. "I am Alpharius, for the Emperor, my lord." Grammaticus's perception was so acute and specialized that he could even lip-read accents. Alpharius was speaking in common Low Gothic, with a rising spur on the middle syllables of Alpharius and Emperor that hinted at a Gedrosian or Cyrenaican basal slant. But the cursal lip motion suggested something akin to Mars Hivecant or even Odrometican. The Cabal had briefed him well, but the problem was that virtually nothing was known about the last Primarch. Unlike all the other Primarchs, Alpharius had never publicly identified his homeworld. Furthermore, no definitive portraits of him were extant. The Cabal had procured many images, but they were clearly contradictory. It was as if Alpharius had many heads. The face Grammaticus was watching through the powerful viewer agreed at least with a few of the historical portraits. There was a certain likeness in the cast of features to both Horus Lupercal and the face the Emperor wore, which made sense if the gene legacy theory was true. Even from a distance, Grammaticus could accurately gauge height and mass. The being he was observing was substantially larger than either Herzog or Pech, the bona fide alphas Grammaticus had encountered in Monlow. Maybe this was the genuine article. The thought of Monlow washed angst back into him, unbidden. His hands began to fidget and shake. The dragon had been in his mind and in his dreams ever since his escape. Of course, he wasn't afraid of it because it was a dragon, or at least he was no more afraid of dragons than any rational human being might be. The real deep fear that chilled his soul was knowing what the dragon represented. He dulled his mind as he felt another psychic pass. Shear was still alive, out there, scanning for him from time to time like a passing spy drone. Grammaticus curled his mind away like an armadillo every time one of Shear's probes came close. The sun beat down. In the distance, he could hear the screaming. This was no life for a thousand-year-old man. Grammaticus was beginning to think he had been a fool to accept the Cabal's gift of reincarnation. He began to wish, honestly and absolutely, that his first death had been his only death. "I wish you'd left me there, bleeding out on the asphalt at Anatol Hive. Why did you bring me back and sleeve me in new flesh? Why? For this?" The Cabal made no answer. They had made no approach to him at all since his return from Monlow. From the moment he'd stolen his way back into Uxor Roxana's quarters, he'd spent hours gazing into mirrors and dishes of water, waiting for Garhet or one of the others to contact him via flecked conduit. They had not come to him. "My life has been long," he considered, "but it is too short for this." He trained the scope back towards the distant meeting. Silent in the hard sunlight, Dinas Chain scaled the terracotta wall and slipped his black armoured form over the parapet onto the roof of the kitchen block. The most recent sensor sweep of the area had picked something up. Or rather, it hadn't. "There are shadows in our shadows, sir," he remembered his own words. Chain had been on his way to search Uxor Roxana's quarters while she was out attending the great meeting, when the security post had flagged the anomaly. The sensor sweep had revealed a vague blank on the roof of the kitchen block, a dead spot that the sensors seemed unable to read or probe. The adepts manning the security post had dismissed it as an imaging artifact, but Chain had not been so quick to judge. In his opinion, The reading suggested someone or something well-veiled, a presence announced by its very absence. Dinas Chain was a wary man. He had been a soldier longer than he had been an adult. Born on Zaus, one of Terra's myriad lost colonies, a planet that had been locked in a brutal global war for almost a century, Chain had grown up on the losing side. Its economy bankrupted by the war effort, its industry shattered by saturation bombing, its menfolk decimated, his birth nation had begun to turn, in desperation, to its remaining assets. It conscripted its womenfolk and its children. Aged 11, Chain had found himself wearing the uniform of the National Youth, carrying an auto rifle and en route to a border outpost to fight. The youngest soldier in his company had been 7. The troop leader had been a boy of 14. They had held the outpost for 26 months. The troop leader had been killed after 3 weeks, 2 days shy of his 15th birthday. Perhaps seeing something only children could see, the troop turned to Chain for leadership. Barely 12 years old, Chain had taken command. By the time he turned 13, he had killed 16 men in open combat and was a hardened, emotionally extinct veteran of that hopeless conflict. Then the fleet of the Imperial Expedition had arrived in close orbit. The war was crushed out in 6 days, and Zaus itself brought to compliance in 6 weeks. It was one of Namet Jira's earliest actions. The brutalized child soldiers were gradually rounded up during the subsequent cleansing campaign, and the fiercest of them paraded before Namet Jira for his amusement. The Lord Commander had always said that there had been something in Chain's face that had marked him out from the other pugnacious, filthy war urchins. Dinas Chain wasn't quite sure what that meant, but he had been placed in the ward of a Lucifer Black officer to be raised as his surrogate son. Aged 18, Chain had joined the Lucifers. 20 years later, he served as the Bajalur of Namet Jira's companion bodyguard, and was one of the most decorated and respected warriors in the regiment. Namet Jira had a good eye for natural-born warriors. Chain crouched low, drawing his short, curved sword of folded Toledo steel. The palace sensors were feeding directly into his visor, conjuring subtle green tactical displays in front of his eyes. There was the blank, the absence, 20 meters left at the rim of the roof. He coiled like a cat and pounced. The rim of the roof was vacant. There was no one there. Nothing. No, not nothing. On the low parapet, there was a scrap of paper held down by a small white stone. The scrap read, "Better luck next time."
"Hey, we're missing everything," said Lon, nudging him.
Sonica woke.
"What?"
"We're late. It started. We should get out there, Het. The regiments have assembled to greet the Astartes."
Sonica sat up. He was in the hospital wing of the Terracotta Palace, where he'd taken a cot to be with the last of his men, the last 10 dancers. The wing was sweltering hot and smelled of stale urine.
"You all right, Het?" asked Shah.
"Yes, I'm fine."
"We may not be a company any more," said Lon, "but I say we go out there and stand in the line like men, like dancers."
"Yeah," agreed Gin.
"You got the flag?" asked Lon.
Shah nodded. He'd been carrying the dancer's tattered standard like a bedroll since Visages.
"Good," said Lon. "Let's go. You coming, Het?"
Sonica was busy getting dressed. He was sweating. He couldn't find his socks.
"Yes, I'm coming, all right." "The Astartes have already landed," said Salom, gazing out of the chamber window. "Hell, there's an awful lot of flag waving and how do you do going on out there?"
"Well, it's Astartes, isn't it?" said Shah. "What do you expect?"
Sonica reached his good hand under his stained pillow in search of his socks. his fingers struck something hard.
"Did one of you put this here?" he asked.
"Put what where?" asked Lon.
Sonica held up a small diorite head, one of the many hundreds of thousands that had given Visages its name.
The last of the dancers all shrugged.
"Must have been me, then,"
Sonica decided.
He already regretted the note. The note had been stupid. Cocky. Yes, cocky was the word. Garhet had forever been reproving Grammaticus for his arrogance and his overconfidence in his logokine powers. A Cabal agent should never bait the killers stalking him, especially if those killers were good at their job. Grammaticus knew enough about the Lucifer Blacks to realize they were terribly good at their job. He'd been a fool to taunt them like that. What had he been thinking? That I'm immortal and nothing can kill me? Mon Lo had shown him how spurious that assumption was. You just can't resist it, can you, John? That's all it is. You can't resist showing off. They're not that good, Grammaticus thought. Not compared to me.
You can't come in, the aide was insisting. Uxor Uxana is away at the Grand Welcome. Her quarters are private.
Grammaticus stepped back into the shadows of the colonnade and listened. He had been slipping his way back to the sanctuary of Ruxana's private quarters, the only place he felt safe. The palace was quiet, with almost everyone outside for the arrival of the Alpha Legion. Coming back along the hallway, he'd heard the voices ahead. Three cowled and robed men stood at the door of Ruxana's quarters, confronting the aide. Their leader was saying,
"You don't understand, aide. I am Tinkers, the surveyor of fabric for the expedition fleet. It's my duty to systematically assess and evaluate all properties captured or commandeered by the expedition. I'm in the process of surveying this palace. The work must be done by order of the fleet master."
He showed the aide some kind of paperwork.
"Don't let them in, Tuvi," Grammaticus willed.
The girl wavered.
"This really isn't a good time, sir. My Uxor's privacy is..."
"I simply need a moment to scan and assess. It's quite uninvasive. A measurement or two. We're not interested in the contents of the chambers. We will be discreet."
"Tuvi, they're not who they say they are. Be cautious. I've met Tinkus, and he doesn't wear a robe, nor is he anywhere close to that height. You're being deceived."
"Well, I suppose," Tuvi said.
"Damn it, Tuvi!"
Grammaticus began to move. As the hooded men shuffled into the Uxor's quarters, past the aide, Grammaticus headed back down the colonnade and climbed out through the last archway. He clambered up onto the roof and crossed the tiles, running low, heading for the far side of the block.
"Give us a moment," the surveyor of fabric told Tuvi, and she nodded, waiting outside.
The door pulled shut behind her. Franco Boone pulled back his cowl.
2 minutes, he told his fellow gene whips. 2 minutes before that little bitch suspects something. Quick and clean, no messing about."
The men, Roke and Pharaon, spread out and began to search the apartment area.
"Boone!"
one of them hissed. Boone hurried into the bedchamber. Pharaon was holding up a canvas jacket, soiled and dirty.
"Since when does an Uxor wear something like this?"
"Bag it and hide it under your robe," Boone replied. "We'll test it for genic elements."
"Here," the other gene whip called urgently. Boone went into the dressing room and found Roke staring at a dresser top crowded with bowls and dishes of water.
"What the hell is this about?" Roke asked.
"Is that you, Ruxana?"
Grammaticus called, walking out of the washroom into the bedchamber, naked. He froze at the sight of Boone and his men and grabbed at the bedspread to cover himself.
"Who are you?"
Grammaticus yelped. Boone hesitated, startled.
Surveyor of fabric, we..."
"Gene Whip Boone? Is that you?"
Grammaticus growled.
"Do I know you, sir?" Boone asked, quite taken aback.
I should think so, Grammaticus snapped. Cato Pius.
Oh, good grief. Yes. Sorry, Hetman Pius, Boone stumbled. Sorry. Sorry, didn't recognize you with your clothes off.
What the hell are you doing in my Uxor's chambers, Gene Whip? Sniffing around?
We had a lead. A lead about a...
A what?
Boone paused. He smiled.
All right, you got me, Het. My hands go up. I wanted to check on Uxor Roxana because of information received.
What sort of information?
That she might be carrying on.
She is, smiled Grammaticus.
With me. It isn't just the aides who like to put it about, you know.
Shouldn't you be out at the great welcome, Het? Theron ventured.
Yes, I should, Grammaticus grinned. But it's much more fun being in here. Shouldn't you be out at the great welcome?
The Gene Whip looked at his feet.
Well, I believe we've just embarrassed each other, Grammaticus said. Me being here and you coming in here unauthorized. So what say we forget this ever happened?
Boone nodded.
That's a splendid notion, Het.
Is that my jacket? Grammaticus asked. Toss it over here. I've been looking for that.
Theron threw the jacket to him.
All good?
Grammaticus asked.
All good, Boone nodded.
Good. Now get the hell out of here and I'll forget you ever tried this.
You won't tell the Uxor?
Boone asked.
Would I?
Boone and his men left. Fast. Grammaticus sighed and sat down on the bed. In looks and build he was nothing like Cato Pius, Het of the Carnivales. It was amazing what a confident, clear tone of voice could do. Such was the strength of a Logokine. A Logokine's voice could tell you what you were seeing in defiance of your eyes and your better judgment. But it had cost him. Exhausted, Grammaticus flopped back on the bed and stared at the ceiling. He knew a blackout was coming. He embraced it, even though he knew there would be dragons in it. Outside, the great welcome was dispersing. Namatjira, with all ceremony, was leading Alpharius and the senior commanders towards his pavilion to discuss forward planning. The vast troop marshals were spilling back towards their billets and positions. Coming out into the sunlight, Franco Boone paused. Walking back through the palace, he'd had a mind to find Uxor Mu and remonstrate with her for sending him on a fool's errand. How clumsy to have embarrassed a distinguished Het like that. Now he was in the open. A mist of doubt filled his head. The encounter in the Uxor's quarters took on a disquieting, dreamlike gloss. He found he could barely remember the actual exchange.
"Something the matter?" asked Roke, walking at his side.
"Cato Pius, right?" Boone asked.
Roke nodded.
"Bear asked. Takes all sorts, I suppose."
"Roxana is a tempting prospect," put in Theron, the other Gene Whip.
Boone nodded. There wasn't a man in the Chiliad who'd disagree with Farron's appraisal.
"But it was Pius, wasn't it?"
Roke and Theron looked at the senior Gene Whip and laughed.
"Are you getting peck that's stronger than we get?" Roke chuckled.
"The question stands," said Boone. "Was that Cato Pius?"
"Yes, Franco," Theron laughed.
"Then explain that to me, would you?" Boone asked, pointing.
Through the crowds of dispersing troopers, 100 meters away, the Chiliad company of Carnivales was breaking ranks to head for their station. Pikes and banners had lowered, the men moving in easy groups, chatting, laughing, taking pinches of peck from their golden boxes. In the midst of the huddle, joking with his bashaws, was Cato Pius.
"Peto! Peto!"
Cato Pius cried in delight. He pushed past his bashaws to embrace Sonica.
"Good to see you," Sonica gasped, clenched in a serious bear hug.
"Good to see you. Good to see you," he says, Pius cried to the Bashaws. "We thought you were dead."
Sonica smiled and embraced each of the Bashaws in turn.
"I very nearly was," he said.
"You got out of visages then?" Pius asked.
Sonica nodded.
"I did, just."
"Where have you been hiding yourself?"
"The hospital wing. I'm staying there with Lon and the others. Hey, Lon, Shah, come over here."
Pius shook his head.
"Shameful, that's what it was. When we heard about visages, we were shocked. My boys have drunk to the dancer's memory several times."
"Thanks for that, Kay," said Sonica. "Glory, it's good to see you."
Pius looked at Sonica.
"Come back with us to our billet. We'll drink and talk of old times."
"Later, Kay. I'll come and find you. Where are you posted?"
"Line 15 North, under Uxor Sans's sept."
"I'll join you later, all right?"
"We'll look out for you, Petto,"
Pius cried, already disappearing in the moving mass. Sonica was pushing on, through the shambling ranks, past the banners of the Threshers and the Arachne. He could see another banner up ahead, above the moving tide of troopers. The Jokers! Sonica pushed his way forwards until he reached the ranks of the Jokers. He had a terrible, queasy feeling.
"Hurtado?"
he whispered. 50 meters away, through the flowing throng, Bronzy turned and looked back at him. The Joker's het was flanked by Che and Leng, his massive Bashaws. For a moment, through the moving crowd, their eyes locked, Sonica and Bronzy.
"Hurt? You're alive. For terror's sake, hurt!"
Bronzy frowned. Then he turned away and was lost in the tide of bodies.
"Hurt?"
Sonica stood still as the river of soldiers flowed around him. He wondered if he should follow Bronzy. He decided that was probably a very bad idea.